I think that what Revelation 3, 7 to 13 is getting at is that we need an eternal perspective. We need a Godward focus in life. That Godward focus in life, that eternal perspective, was for the Philadelphians to endure persecution. For us, who don't deal with persecution as much, I think it's to be able to endure suffering and prosperity. I wonder, what causes you to be deeply angry? What keeps you up at night with anxiety and worry? What causes you to feel overwhelmed and depressed? What are your sources of suffering and pain? I could imagine that it could be something like this, catching wind from a couple of your friends that they're doing something on Saturday night. They won't give you clear answers. You just know that this person's doing something and that person's doing something, and you don't know what it is, but you're not invited. So what does that do? It keeps you up at night. And you wonder, you mull, what are they doing? How come I wasn't invited? That's suffering. Deep suffering. Kids, you know suffering. You know suffering because you know what it's like to have parents who just don't understand. You want an iPod, an iPad to go with your iPhone, and they won't let you have it. It's rough. You're the only kid without a flat screen in your room. I understand. Your parents just won't let you go see Paranormal Activity 3, and everyone else has already seen it. They won't let you drive with your friends to the 9:30 club. I know what it's like to suffer like that, because when I was in the third grade, I wanted parachute pants. And do you know when I got them? In sixth grade, 2 years after they were out of style. Parents don't understand. That's suffering. A few weeks ago, Dean Miller preached, and Dean preached about my problems. You know what he said? He said, let's say someone loves the NFL a little too much. You've got games scheduled all day long. The early game, the afternoon game, the late game, the Monday night game. You're in three or four fantasy teams. You spend time worried about this. You own all of the gear for your team, and you don't even work out. Your body, your money, your time, your emotions are all keyed into the NFL. Dean, when I listened to that sermon, it almost brought tears to my eyes. I had to pull out my hanky and wipe. Dean knows my pain. You see, my pain and sorrow is like this. When the Pittsburgh Steelers lose, I'm really, really broken. It's true. I do. But it's important. I mean, the NFL is important. Steelers' victories are important. They're vital to my joy and pleasure in life. When they lose, I suffer deeply. Everyone around me suffers deeply. Not being invited to the party, parents who don't understand, losing, what kind of suffering do we know? We kind of know first world suffering, don't we? It's the kind of suffering that says, ugh, my sheets, my blanket, there's too much on me. I got to get it off. No, I've got to get it back on. You know the suffering we have at night with our bed pillows? You know what suffering is for most of us? It's like this summer when our air conditioning was out for 3 days. I mean, that's rough. It is. It's true suffering. Quite frankly, I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed about what gets me upset in life, about how I define suffering and pain on a daily basis. I'm embarrassed that the kinds of things that should just be speed bumps in the road end up becoming chasms that I can't seem to cross. I think I'm very aware at times about how I need to be reoriented heavenward. I need to get an eternal perspective. It's what Paul said in Colossians 3:2 when he said, set your minds on things that are above. That means on eternal things, on God things, on things that last, not on things of the earth, things that are temporary. I'm pretty sure if I could hold on to that eternal perspective, that it might take away my infatuation with the temporary and fleeting. Like the approval of friends, the desire for success in my work, the pleasure of food or sex, the joy of winning a football game. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm a big fan of friends and success and sex and football. But these are not the ultimate things. Having them does not ultimately satisfy us. Being denied them does not ultimately destroy us. Or at least it shouldn't. If I could hold on to that eternal perspective, I might drop that infatuation with the temporary and fleeting. And I might also not be tyrannized by my circumstances changing, by the things that should just be speed bumps and detours in life. Not getting what I want when I want it, not being invited, not winning. These things should not control me the way they do. If I could just keep an eternal perspective. And maybe if I could keep eternity in focus, I might be able to withstand the true storms of life, to patiently endure when real hardship comes, real loss, real suffering, real brokenness. This is what Jesus was after in Revelation 3:7-13, when he preached a message of assurance and hope in eternity to the persecuted and suffering church in Philadelphia. Essentially, what Jesus is doing is he wants them to have a heavenward orientation so that they will have hope regardless of what happens to them in life. And he wants to assure them that they will enter eternity and all wrongs will be made right, that they will endure, they will get there. Let's look at what Jesus says to that Philadelphian church and see maybe if it has something to say about our lives in this fallen and broken and sinful world where it's not just prosperity that gets in our way, but real pain, real trouble, and real suffering. In Revelation 3, Jesus encourages the Philadelphians. This is one of the two letters that is entirely positive. He doesn't say, but I have this against you. Instead, he encouraged them. He says in verse 8, you have kept my word. You have not denied my name. And in verse 10, you have patiently endured. He praises them. But he also notes their difficulties, their suffering. He says, I know that you are weak, verse 8. He identifies people who are in power and persecuting them in verse 9. And in verse 10, he says he knows that they are enduring an hour of trial, and he will get them through. What all of these things tell us is that Jesus knows them intimately and personally. He knows exactly what they're experiencing. And his assurance is directed to their experience. Jesus says to them in verse 7 and 8, in his assurance of them, he says, I've set before you an open door which no one can shut. Now, it's possible that this could mean something like an open door for opportunity or mission, but I think, given the context in Revelation, that the open door is referenced to an access into God's presence, access to eternity. Revelation 3:20 talks about knocking and the door being opened and eating with Christ. And Revelation 4:1 says the heavens opened and we are in the presence of God. So what Jesus is saying is, because your faith is in me, the door is open. The way is open. Jesus is the way. And the way open is secure for them. In Revelation 3, Jesus assures the Philadelphian church that the way to eternity is open by and through him. This is much like Paul's encouragement to the Corinthian church in 2 Corinthians 4 when he talks to them about the suffering and hardship they've dealt with. And Paul is somebody who knew a little bit about hardship, I think. Stoned to death and left for dead, but he was still okay. Whipped and beaten to the point of death. Starving, imprisoned, falsely accused. Horrid things happened to Paul. And yet, this is what he says. He says, we don't lose heart. This is just a slight and momentary affliction. This slight and momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory that cannot be compared to. And so we look not for the things that are seen and transient, but for the things that are unseen and eternal. That's what Jesus is trying to do to this Philadelphian church. He's saying, fix your eyes past what you're dealing with right now. Fix them on eternity. This is the same thing Jesus does according to Hebrews 12:2. It says, Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. What is that idea like? That idea is something like this. Jesus has the cross in front of him, but he's not looking at the cross. He's looking past the cross to being with his Father, to the glory that he will experience, to the joy and pleasure of eternal presence with his Father. So who for the joy set before him endured the cross and went through it? He still had to endure it, but that's not where he was focused, right? Revelation 3 is essentially a message of assurance, getting their minds and eye focused heavenward. He promises this Philadelphian church in verse 9 that their enemies will bow down to them and they will be vindicated. In verse 11, that they will be rewarded if they endure faithfully. And then in verse 12, I think he gets at something that is very personal and unique, but it's hard to see that on first read. He says, I will write on you the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven. What Jesus is saying is you are and will be citizens in eternity, citizens in God's eternal city. Now, why might that be significant? I'm going to speculate a little bit here. The early church, when they were facing persecution, that early church was treated as illegal aliens. They were no longer given the rights of Roman citizenship. They were not protected in the local synagogues. They were forced out. They probably were still in their hometown, the village and cities they grew up in. The people of the Philadelphian church probably had lived there their whole lives and now probably are no longer considered citizens. They're considered outsiders. They're a people with no place. Jesus' assurance to them is, you have a place. You have a city. You are citizens. Just wait. Just wait. You see, the God of the Bible is not just the God who rights all wrongs. He's the God who rights your wrongs. To the orphan and widow, he is the loving Father they long for. To the harassed and lost, he is the good shepherd who comforts them and protects them. To the hungry, he's the provider. To the sick, the healer. To the homeless and alien, the persecuted Philadelphian church, he promises a home with him, a city in which they will belong. He gives the lonely wanderer a place. So Jesus' message to the Philadelphians is not just some rah-rah promise of future victory and vindication. Hang on and you'll win. Nor is it some empty Hallmark good wish. Don't worry, guys. You might be sawn in two, but it'll be okay someday. It's going to be all right. It's not an empty, vague, generic hope in heaven. It comes across as the message of a God who knows their pain, who knows their fears, who knows their plight, and who promises very personally to heal and restore them one day. Is God any different with us? You know, most of us have not dealt with persecution like the early church. We have not dealt with imprisonment, torture, death. I mean, I dealt with persecution for a little bit when I was in college, and it was something like this. It was when the Branch Davidians, that cult was going on down in Waco, Texas, and the whole thing was in the news. Well, my hall mates, first year hall, knew that I was a Christian and had Bible studies occasionally in my room. So they decided to mix the two in a little bit of mockery. My door sign, which had said John Kersina, was switched. The John was crossed out, and instead of saying John Kersina, they said Branch Kersinians. Because the cult was known as the Branch Davidians. But really, is that it? I mean, is that bad? So they made fun of me because they knew I was a Christian. But even that, it's kind of funny. Most of the persecution we deal with gets at us because of our pride and our lack of ability to laugh. It's not real persecution. But that doesn't mean we don't suffer. If you're alive in this fallen world, you will or have suffered. I think we all need Jesus' words of assurance, his personal reminder of eternity, because we all deal with pain and brokenness and hardship, or we will one day. Some hardships last a few days. Like 7 years ago, I went to bed on Christmas Eve feeling awful, and I woke up with a full-blown flu. Nausea, pain, excruciating, fever, feeling completely awful. Sarah and the kids kindly escaped and drove to Alexandria to get away from me because they did not want to be afflicted by my plague. And there I was on Christmas morning feeling pretty awful, feeling lonely, all alone, and in a lot of pain. But you know what? At least for that brief moment, I started to think about eternity. It was a short 3-day bit of suffering, and I thought, oh, thank God that one day this will be done away with. One day there'll be no more flu, or broken arms, or cancer. Suffering can orient us heavenward. It can also give us some measure of hope to endure. Not all suffering is a few days like the flu. Sometimes it lasts for years. Sometimes it's terminal. Maybe that's what you're dealing with this morning. I have one friend who is dealing with deep frustration at work. He said, I've been here for 10 years in this job. Where is it all going? What am I doing? His years of deeply unsatisfying work are so defeating and depressing. And he doesn't know where to turn. He feels cornered and overwhelmed. We are people who deal with real suffering. A married woman who struggles with infertility, desperately wanting a child but unable to succeed. That is real pain. The pain of barrenness is like an empty house when you long for a home. It's hearing laughter of children and feeling like you're being taunted. It's symbolic of all of our unfulfilled longings, those deep pains that many of us have that are not fulfilled. Some pain is the result of sin. I've had several friends recently whose spouses have left them and their kids because they found another person who could finally meet their needs and make them happy. Seriously? But can you imagine the pain of being abandoned in this way? I mean, what are you going to say to your kids? How do you feel about yourself the rest of your life? Embarrassment, shame, and all as a result of sin. I hope that none of you have dealt with this pain, but I'm sure some of you have. So how does a message like Jesus' message to the Philadelphians, this assurance of heaven, provide any encouragement, any hope to real life suffering? I mean, doesn't the promise of heaven sound kind of trite to someone who is dealing with barrenness or infidelity or deep depression? It kind of does. But as we noted, Jesus does not just give a generic, oh, it'll be okay, to the Philadelphians. Jesus does for them what he does for all of us. He points us to God the Father, to the eternal kingdom of God, but he always does so, in a very personal and intimate sort of way. Jesus does not give Zacchaeus the healing sight for his blindness. He gives him friendship, dignity, what he actually needed. To the depressed laborer, Jesus reminds them, "You are my workmanship, created for good works now and always, and I have a plan and purpose for you, even now." To the barren and empty, Jesus gives a picture of heaven that is a home with our Father, of joy and laughter and fullness and family, of all of our deepest longings fulfilled. To the abandoned spouse, Jesus shows himself to be the true groom, the one who sees our deep flaws, our ugliness, our sin, and yet loves us unconditionally. He's not going to go away from us. Jesus' message of assurance, of hope in eternity to the Philadelphians, points us to a God who knows us and loves us deeply and wants to meet our needs now and eternally. It can give us hope and the ability to endure the deepest of disappointments, our unfulfilled longings, real pain and suffering from sin and sickness. It can help us to face even death. 7 weeks ago, I got a call from a friend in our old neighborhood. It was that extremely rainy Thursday. The rain was just pouring down all day long. Everything was flooded. And he called and said, "Johnny, you've got to get over here. A boy in the neighborhood named Jack is gone. We can't find him. He was seen last near the creek playing with his friends. Come over here." I got over to the neighborhood, and there was police everywhere, people walking up and down the creek. I went and talked with the family, with others standing around, found out what had happened. In a break in the rain, he had gone out with two neighbor boys and with his sister. They'd gone down to play in the creek that they had played in, the creek that my own kids had played in 2 years ago, the creek that I had played in as a little boy. And then he was gone. I remember as it got dark, standing outside in the rain, praying, "God, show up, just show up, because you are able to find this boy wherever he is." About 2 hours later, the police came and said they had found his body. A couple of weeks later, a group of us guys got together, including Tim, the dad, to kind of talk about life and death and God. And we were talking about Jack's death that night. And I remember one guy said, "All I could think about is how would I deal with that if that was my own son? And what in the world do I say to Tim and Anna?" And I wondered, how will they go on? How do you face that kind of tragic pain and suffering and keep going in life? How do you deal with death, which is the ultimate suffering, the ultimate inhumane thing in this world? I think a starting place is a real and living hope in eternity. A couple days later, at Jack's funeral, his mom got up to say a few words, and she shared this. I want to tell you that the concept of eternity scared Jack. It seemed, well, a little too long for him. Then 2 years ago at a Christian summer camp, he had a conversation with a counselor. They discussed heaven and eternity in a way that helped Jack to stop being afraid. In fact, he was excited about heaven. He didn't understand why people could be afraid to die, because he truly believed there was no better place. Anna goes on to say, "Our handsome Jack, our sweet boy, died in a tragic accident. We all wish we could turn back the clock. Our hearts are breaking for what could have been. But you know what? We truly believe our homebody Jack is home, in a better home than any of us could ever imagine." Tim and Anna, Jack's sister, will probably mourn and ache the loss of this boy the rest of their life. I don't fully know how they will endure, because I can't imagine it myself. But I know it starts. It starts with having a real living hope in eternity. The hope that there is a home that we are made for, and this is not it. In John 14, Jesus assures his disciples. It's the night before his own crucifixion, and he says, "I am going to be with the Father to prepare a room for you in my Father's house, so that where I am going, you will be also." This is the hope of an eternal home with God our Father. This is where we belong. Having a very real hope in that home is the start of enduring. But I think it also involves trusting the one who gets us there. Jesus said in John 14 as well, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Jesus shows himself again and again as the answer to our unfulfilled longings, the healer of our deepest suffering, the source of true and eternal joys. If you have dealt with or are dealing with real deep brokenness, heartache, pain, I don't know exactly what it's going to look like for you to endure. But I know it starts with turning to Jesus, clinging to Jesus, holding on to Jesus when the suffering is greatest. A few verses past our passage, Jesus says, "I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with him and he with me." If you're looking for satisfaction and have not found it, if you want hope and joy despite a life that does not look like that, if you want to be able to face the pain and brokenness and fragility of this life with any sense of encouragement, open that door for the first time or every day. Jesus, I want to sup with you. God does not promise us prosperity and success, ease in this life. He doesn't promise us we'll have flat screens and Super Bowl victories. But as we face disappointments and pain and suffering and even death, he gives us the only source of true and lasting hope. He gives us himself. And that's what we really need. Let's pray. Almighty God, I thank you that you are a loving Father. You know our needs and our brokenness and our pain. You know our whacked out priorities. You know our fears. You know what keeps us up at night. I pray that you would show yourself to us very really and very personally, and that we might have the faith to cling to your Son, Jesus, to place our hope in what lasts. Amen.